Hello and welcome to the show. We've got a great one for you tonight. First of all, the first part of the show is pre-recorded. It was done on Sunday, and I am very happy to have, well, my former basically newscaster, Michael Lauck, is joining us. Alejandro Rojas is on a cruise, as I mentioned last week. And with Michael Lauck, I have the one and only Calvin Parker. We're going to be talking about the Pascagoula incident, how it all came about to where he's at today. There's a lot of things going on and exciting things for Calvin and the case itself. We're going to talk a bit about that. And after the first break, I have Charlotte Mann is going to be talking. Her grandfather was the one that was involved in the Cape Girardeau. Thank you, Michael. The Cape Girardeau incident. You always did bail me out, Michael. Thank you. Incident back in 1941. It was a reverend that came to a was actually summoned to a crash site to bless these small bodies. We're going to be talking all about that. And that starts after the first break. For now, I think I will introduce the guest, the guy that just bailed me out, Michael Lauck, and Calvin Parker. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for having us, Martin.
Yeah, thanks for having us. It's good to be back.
I know. Michael, it's been a long time since you've been on the show, right? A couple, three, 4 years, maybe.
Ooh, probably, yeah. I've weird schedules always, so, you know. And the last time I think I was on, I was guest hosting for you, so you weren't on.
That's right. I think it was Stan Friedman, maybe.
Yes, I'm the guy who interviewed Stan Friedman, and we didn't talk about UFOs.
Not even flying saucers?
No.
How about that?
No, we talked about his career. It was great.
Oh, that's awesome. Well, now, I want to, Michael, I want to thank you because this whole thing that has happened with Calvin all started with you. You wrote a blog back in 2013 about the Pascagoula incident, and Calvin reached out to me about that blog, and one thing led to another, and boy, has it ever snowballed ever since that, hasn't it, Calvin?
Oh, I guarantee you. It's been a real blessing, this show, to me. It put me in touch with Philip and a lot of other things. And, I mean, it's just gone wild. Every day something new comes up.
I'm on Philip's mailing list, and I can't get over it. It seems like every day there's something major going on. Why don't you tell us what's happened since what is going on as far as you've been on news stations, you've been on all kinds of things.
Yeah, it's been a lot of major news stations, such as Fox News, Waterworld, then all these local stations around here. But it's been a number of news stations that I've been on. I never really wrote this book to get it popular or nothing. I did it to just set the record straight and my story, because it had been changed so much by the news. And I had every news agent in the world mad at me because I wouldn't give an interview. Now all of them's wanting to come to me. They're wanting interviews with me. And, of course, I do it. I'm going to do it for about a year or so.
I remember you saying that. And then you're just going to fade back into the background again, right?
That's exactly right. Hopefully this coming October. Now, I've already got a couple of conferences that I signed up for on a contract. I'll do them after, you know, next year. But as far as that, when they over, I'm gone. I'll be fishing again. Uh-huh. I'll be off grid.
I think Michael's article, that was one you didn't have to correct. I don't believe. I remember you just writing me about it. And I said, this isn't the Calvin Parker, is it?
Yeah.
Because no one could get a hold of you for years, right?
Oh, I would completely avoid everything. But for some reason, I was drawn to the article, and I felt I needed to respond some. But I really didn't want to get in the spotlight. But as you know, that all changed pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah.
If it hadn't been for you, Martin, there wouldn't be a book, because Philip contacted you to get a hold of me, and that's the way that we touch base together.
Yeah, I remember when you and I had a conversation, you said you were thinking about a book, right, at that time?
I was, but all it was a thought. Even up until I decided to write a book, it was still a thought. I actually told my wife, she's the one that started all of it, and by luck of all things, the next day, Philip had contacted you for me to contact him. Well, it still took him a couple of weeks to talk me into it. And the one reason I did, I felt like I owed an explanation to everybody that was I never talked this to my wife or my family or anyone else. And I didn't want to tell this that many times. So I thought, well, you know, the book will be a good deal. I can tell it one time, then they can buy it if they want to hear the story, or I give them a copy.
And you were kind enough to send me a copy. And boy, is that, how many pages is that book?
I'm not for sure. Around 800, I think. It's a bunch of them.
It's like a Bible. Yeah, it's huge.
Philip really did his homework on getting together all the articles and everything in it. I think he did a great job with it.
Michael, jump in anytime you want if you have any questions.
Oh, yeah, of course. I got to say, I'm impressed. 800 pages, that is a tome.
It is. Actually, when I was writing the book, he was putting together all the homework and all. I had lost all my information in Katrina. My house once again flooded.
Oh.
And once you flood and get all this water in, it's gone. Mm. So while he was getting that together, I was writing on the book. And the one deal that Philip and I had together, I said, Philip, you know, I'll agree to do this book, but I don't have any education, but I still don't want you to edit this book in any way. I don't want you to correct any spelling. I don't want you to punctuation or changing anything that I put in it. And he agreed, and I figured I'd have to argue with him about it, but he's really held to it and did good by it, and I appreciate him for it.
Wow. That's really great. So it's more in your own words than if anyone touched it. That's wonderful.
It is. It is my own words. Nothing's been changed in it.
I know there's a, you know, the one thing I have to say is I do have a lot of new listeners to the show. You were on about, I think, 7 or 8 months ago on my show. And I hate to do this for the person that knows the case really well, but can you kind of give, for the new listener, can you kind of give a nutshell story of what happened, please?
We can. I was working in the oil field in Laurel, Mississippi, and it was 16 hours a day, 7 days a week. So I wanted to change jobs, and I called a friend of my father's, which was Charlie Hickson, but I knew him, and I was brought up with him. So, anyway, he told me to come and go to work and go to work at the shipyard with him. So I agreed to do that. So I rented a room from Charlie and moved in. So we went to work that day. I was just down there one day. And we rented the room that day from him and worked. And I decided to go fishing after that. Well, this was in October 11th of 1973. So when we got off work, we left and went fishing. And we went to an old abandoned shipyard. It was called Shaw Peter Shipyard. And I remember getting there, and there was a no trespassing sign up. But we still went on in. He said it was okay. I didn't know if it was or not. So we were sitting there fishing, and I noticed some blue lights behind us. And it was the same color as a patrol car. So I actually thought we was fixing to get run off or go to jail for trespassing, which would have been fine with me because I was tired anyway. So anyhow, I was sitting there looking at the boat across, and I seen an old steel hull ship. And I was thinking, how do these things float? You know, they're really heavy, and I don't know how they float. And that's when I noticed the blue lights coming from behind me. So as the blue lights was coming from behind me, I turned around and looked because I thought I was fixing to go to jail for trespassing. So when we stood up, we noticed a bright light in behind us, and all of a sudden we just turned the stood up and turned around, and the light was real bright, and that's when we noticed three. We couldn't make them out because the lights were so bright. That's when we noticed three robotic-looking beings that was coming toward us. And as they approached us, two of them got a hold of Charlie and one got a hold of myself. And that's when I kind of felt an injection in my arm, probably to settle me down. I don't know what it was for, but, you know, I was scared when this was going on. But after the injection, I noticed my body was more or less paralyzed. Now, I could turn my head one way or another, and I could roll my eyes and look, but I couldn't move my body around from one end to the other. So, anyhow, they picked us up, levitated us up, floated us to the ship, and that's when I noticed on the ship that the lights were so bright in there, and I couldn't figure out where they was coming from. There was no light fixtures. It looked like they was just coming out of the walls. So I did notice that because I was curious where all these bright lights was come from. Well, they took me into a different room than what they did the guy that was with me, and they laid me on an examination table. And I was at about a 45-degree angle when I was on this table. So I noticed from the ceiling, though, that something dropped out of the ceiling about the size of a deck of cards, and it rotated around my head. It clicked four times. Then it went back up into the wall. So when it did that, this big, ugly creature that I call him, the robotic-looking creature or soldier, stepped back, and there was this smaller-looking, female-looking creature. And I call it a female because she was smaller built than the other ones, and it just felt more like she was a female than a male. She came out of the room. She kind of peached me on the cheek, and that's when I noticed her fingers was a little longer on her hands. Her two middle fingers were a little longer on her hands than what this other creature had. And she run her finger down my throat and tried to come up behind that little deal that hangs down back there. I don't know what to call it. And that's when I started strangling and having a problem because she was choking me and was into my nasal cavities. So I kind of panicked. And that's when I noticed she backed up and just a little bit, and her mouth didn't move. She had a mouth, nose, and ears just like we did. Her mouth never moved. She kind of telepathically told me, "Don't worry, we're not going to hurt you." But, you know, by then I was already bleeding and strangling. I was scared. So she made a little mumble with her throat, really didn't say nothing. And this big, ugly creature came back in, grabbed me by the arm, and that's when I felt a second injection into my arm, and I kind of settled down. He floated us back out to the river and set us down, and I was at the river with my arms stretched out. I couldn't move, just facing it. And that's when I heard Charlie, "Son, son, you okay?" And we turned around. The big bright light went out. The blue hazy lights came back on. This thing lifted up and left. And it was just from that time on, or the next morning on, it was just a nightmare with the media. I guess every media in the world, and I'm not saying just here in the United States, but they picked it up, all the overseas countries and everything else. I didn't realize how big it was till I started looking through the book where Philip had gathered all this information. But
wow.
It has stayed with me for 45 years. It completely changed my life. I went from getting married, working the same job, retiring, buying a house, and fishing, to losing a job, getting an examination, and leaving all in the same day. I had that job on the coast one day after this happened to me.
Wow.
Then I got fired and all, so, or pretty much, because they told us not to come back until the media settled down. And I often wondered if maybe that's why Charlie didn't go back. If maybe he seen a little break to do these conferences and maybe make a few dollars. You know, he was a little older. and just do that instead of trying to find another job, because he might have thought, you know, maybe nobody else would hire him. Of course, everybody knew what happened to me, but nobody asked questions. I got home, my wife didn't ask, or she wasn't my wife then, but she didn't ask what happened. My family didn't ask. My friends didn't ask. And I dang sure didn't tell them.
Wow.
So I just hid it for 45 years up until July of last year, I guess, when the book came out.
Wow, really something. Michael, I have a question to ask, but go ahead if you have something you'd like to throw in.
Well, you know, you seem pretty comfortable with it now, talking about it, things like that. It are there any, other than how it's affected your life and, you know, your relationships and your working and all that, how is it, do you wake up at night? Can you watch or hear other people's stories of encounters, or does that bother you, or is there a fear at all of about what happened?
Well, it's still a fear in a way, because I would like to know why it happened, which I'm almost sure I'll never figure that out. And that's why I'm asking witnesses to come forward that might have seen something, that maybe they shed a little light on it. But I do think it affected my health. And the reason I say that is for 45 years, I couldn't sleep at night until this book came out and I wrote it. So I was up. I've had a stroke and two major heart attacks and two open heart surgeries.
Wow.
And I'm still not healthy. And it's like I tell everybody, you know, it's an expiration date stamped on my head. So you got to, I wanted to get this out before I expired and just left everybody in the open not knowing. And so it's been a good thing for me. It's taught me how to deal with everything now.
Now, did you ever read the book that Charlie did?
No, sir, I didn't. Never read it. Charlie came to me one day and said, I'm going to write a book. I'll give you 3% of it, which everybody knows 3% ain't nothing anyhow. I didn't care about no percentage. I just signed a contract and said, write it. I don't care, Charlie. So, you know, that's where it was left. I never opened it, although Philip sent me a copy of it. And I have a chance, so, and I understand he's got a lot of good information in the book, a lot of witnesses and things like that, but I've never read it.
Now, did you, you know, you said you kept quiet about this for so long, but did you, did people recognize your name here and there along the way all these years and strike up a conversation about it?
Absolutely, but I wouldn't talk about it. And that is another reason that the book was written. I was at a friend's wake, and I signed a register at his wake, and it was in Pascagoula. And these people started coming up, are you the Calvin Parker? I said, well, I guess I am. That's my name. So they started asking me a lot of questions. I didn't feel like that was the place to answer any of the questions, so we left. And that's when my wife started talking to me and said, well, maybe you ought to write a book. I said, why not? I don't have an education. I can't spell my own name. So maybe if I get a ghostwriter, you know, we might do this. That was just to satisfy her and pass her off, and maybe she'd forget all about it. Well, darn, the next day I got a letter from you asking if it was okay to give Philip my contact information. Then Philip called on a completely unrelated event, and he called on an unrelated event and wanted to talk to me about Charlie's book, which I didn't know anything about. So it led into him saying, well, why don't you do your own? That would be your legacy. You know, we talked, and I told him everything got changed, and it'd be written black and white. So I told him, maybe let me think about it, and I was going to blow him off. So it was about 2 weeks later he called back, and I told him, well, let me think about it. And then he happened to call back a few days again, and I actually said, yeah, I'll do it. He said, well, it might take you 2 or 3 years to do this. I said, I don't know how long it takes. If I can read a book in a week, I can write the darn thing in a week. And that's what I did. I went to my room. I told my wife, I'm not taking no phone calls. Bring me something to eat once a day. And don't bother me. This went on for 2 weeks. I stayed locked up in my room. And as I was putting it together, then Philip was putting his part together, and we just merged them all together then.
Isn't that something? Boy, you should write more books if you can do it in 2 weeks.
Actually, I want to talk to you more about how you get your wife to do that, because I've written a couple books, and it does not come off like that for me.
It's hard. Every now and then she'd come knock on the door. I'd say, get out of here. And that's what she did.
Wow. Hey, is there any talk of a documentary or anything like that about the whole incident? Have you been involved in anything like that?
I pretty much let Philip handle it. But it has been talk about documentaries. It's been talk about movies and things like that. But we are both trying to keep it as realistic as what you can if some of this does happen. Mm-hmm. And in that way, it scares a lot of these movie companies and all off, because they want to create their own version of it.
Sure.
And, little changes here and there would work out. Like, just say there was five police come out and they don't use but two or three, that would be the only difference or something that I would accept. I'm not going to accept anything change in the basic story. So that scares them all off.
Yeah. Well, maybe eventually they'll agree to that. I know I had a conversation with Travis Walton, and he said that, yes, they did, in Fire in the Sky, the movie, they did. And, this didn't happen. That didn't happen. But he said overall he was still happy that it got out, but they will do that. They, for some reason, even though it's such a spectacular case, they seem to always have to sensationalize it a little more than it is for some reason.
Exactly right. And I don't understand that. How can you get more out of what's happened and what's going on?
Right. Now, the description of I saw this model that was made, and the description of the being that you saw with the like carrot things coming out of where the ear should be and the single one coming out of the eye. No one has ever talked about anything that looked like that before or after, as far as I know. And one thing I started thinking about, and I wrote on Philip's Facebook page when he posted that picture, is I'm wondering if those things were some type of sensors.
I've often thought about that. Now, during the stage, Charlie seen them up close, and that was his
that's
artist
right.
And him
Charlie.
That done it. Mm-hmm. Now, I never really got a good look in their face at them.
Yeah.
I did see the female real close, and now I have a artist that I'm working with, and we're trying to get it as close to perfection as what we can. Of course, after 45 years without doing a lot of thinking, and figuring, it's hard to do. So it's just when it gets perfect, we're going to release that.
And no matter how striking the memory is, we're all fallible when it comes to remembering something exactly the way it is over the years.
Exactly right. You can put 10 people out to witness something, and every one of them will witness something different.
That's right. Now, we've got about 3 minutes or so left. I just wanted to know if you could touch on anything that was a revelation that you saw that Philip found, and put into the book that you had no idea about.
The one thing was Bud Hopkins had tried to hypnotize me, and I never really thought he had hypnotized me. This was in 93. And I just mentioned to Philip that Bud tried, and Bud had passed away, and he got the original tape from Dr. Jacobs. I never knew I was hypnotized up until I read it in the book. And I went out and told my wife, I said, I didn't think that really happened. I didn't know. But he had put a post-hypnotic suggestion that I wouldn't remember it. So that was all amazing to me. That was something new that I didn't know, and I started briefly. I hadn't read the whole transcripts of it because I want to remember it like I won't remember it. I don't remember it like what come off a tape. Yeah. So I'm still in that process.
Okay. Anything else? Anything else that was interesting in the book that you didn't know about?
I'm sure it's quite a few things. I actually need to sit down and read the book to see what is in it. Okay. I've never really read it.
Well, it
I've been so
many
busy
pages.
Since this came out. Y'all, I'm telling you. When this came out, it was number one bestseller at Amazon. The day it come out, it stayed like that a long time. And I'm not for sure where it is now. I don't never check it. And, of course, everybody knows, every author knows it's involved in this field. It's no money in these books.
Yeah, that's
you know,
right. Yeah.
You do that because you want to do it.
Yeah.
And I have no reason to fabricate anything like this. I just go on what my word is. Somebody said, well, I don't believe you. I said, well, I don't care if you believe me or not.
Yeah.
It don't mean that much to me if you believe me or not.
Yeah, I saw someone attacked you on Facebook, too, and there's no need for that. That's ridiculous.
No.
A lot of it has to do with fears. You know, when people have a fear of something, they attack.
They do. Yeah. My wife had went up, and somebody had made some jewelry for her, and she asked if she could sell it, or she could sell it for them. And I gave her permission. I said, yeah, you know, because it's got my name and all. If you want to do something and make you a few dollars at these conferences or something, that would be fine. And somebody popped up. I forget what words they used. I hate to see you relate to doing costume jewelry and all this. Of course, I just told him go to hell. Yeah. I didn't care.
Yeah, that's right. Michael, you have one last question or anything to add?
No, actually, you know, I haven't had a chance to read the book yet, and I am looking forward to it now. I'm glad to hear that ultimately you're doing really well. And it sounds like you've kind of come to terms and kind of made peace with this as much as you can. And
right.
It's just great to know that you're doing great, because so many of these stories end up kind of not turning out so well. And I'm really happy for you.
Well, thank you. When you read the book, call me or something and let me know what you think.
I will. And don't worry about not making money off any books. I can assure you there's no money in fiction either.
No.
Yeah, that's right. You've written. Yeah. All right. Well, we are at the break now. Thanks so much, gentlemen. It's been such a pleasure. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Will you post me a link to this on my...
Oh, sure. Will do. All right.
Hey.
Okay, everyone. So that's it. We are going to be back right after this break with Charlotte Mann. So hang in there. We'll be right back.
Thanks.
William Huffman, back in 1941, I believe it was April. You know, we think of the modern-day ufology as 1947. Well, this happened well before that, 6 years before that. And it's a real, real interesting case. Her grandfather only wanted to talk about it once in his life. And I have a lot of questions to ask her. So welcome to the show, Charlotte.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you having me.
Sure. And it's been a long time. Now, this is something I wanted to bring up. How we met is really a crazy situation. I had a guest blog on my website, podcastufo.com, and you found it, and then you also saw the show number, and you just happened to dial it to talk to me while I had a show going on. And I had no idea when you first called, like, Charlotte Mann, that name sounds familiar, but you said you had some errors on your website. And so anyway, I did not write that blog, so I took it down. And you're here to set the record straight, and I really do appreciate you coming on.
Well, I'm glad that you gave me the platform to do so. I'm not the type that likes to undermine other people, but when someone talks about your family in a very personal way and yourself as well, as if they know you intimately and they know what you were thinking when you did things, that kind of crosses the line with me, and I had just about had enough of it.
Sure, yeah. So I'm sure you see that all over the place.
Everywhere. I'm all over the internet, and with most of them, when people call me and say, Charlotte, I read this, or what about this, and I look, and it's people I've never met. I wouldn't know them if I passed them on the street. And that was a surprise to me and very disconcerting to me, simply because my grandfather's experience was just that. And what I tried to do is be an authentic witness to his experience. But I'm not used to the politics and the things that go on. I'm not used to people totally lying about you. So
that's good.
A strong word. Yeah, it's not good. And I'm not used to it, and I haven't had it around me. So it was kind of hard to deal with in the beginning.
Well,
I'm a private person.
Sure. Now, if that the blog, that the guest blog, you know, I can't even remember who wrote that and sent it in to me, but if there was inaccuracies, I've already said this to you on the phone, but I really do apologize that that was out there, and it's gone now. So I would like for you, if you would, there's a lot of people that just are not familiar with this story at all. If you can just go into detail on what you know about what happened, that would be wonderful.
Well, what literally happened, and it's been bits and pieces of it told. I've only given permission to one person to tell the story in the very beginning, and that was on the privacy that he wouldn't reveal me or the source. But Lynn Stringfield, who's a researcher, I thoroughly enjoyed him. I never got to meet him in person, but I had... it was early in the spring of 1941. It was April. And I know and have been exact with that, although I've had a lot of people try to change that, try to tell me it wasn't that time or wasn't it Easter. And it isn't, because my mother at the time was expecting my older sister, and she was born May the 3rd. So I'm very strong on the time. But the family was together visiting my grandmother and my grandfather, who lived in Cape Girardeau, Missouri at the time. And about 9 or 9:30, my granddad got a phone call. He's a Southern Baptist minister, or was. And someone had called in and said that there had been what they thought was a small plane crash outside of town, and if they sent a car for him, would he come and ride along in case there were people that were injured that might need prayer or emotional support from a religious figure? And he agreed, and so a little while later, a car came and picked him up. And he was gone for a while, and the family speculated and actually prayed, hoping no one was deceased. But when Grandfather got there, it wasn't at all what he expected or the people that had picked him up expected. It turned out to have been a crashed UFO, and there were three aliens that had been inside, I'm assuming, and either thrown from the vehicle or taken out of the vehicle and were laying on the ground. And Grandfather was able to walk up to part of the UFO was kind of crashed open, laying open, and he could see inside, and he saw many gauges and instruments and things that didn't look familiar to him. One of the things that he mentioned to my dad, and I've not ever spoken of this, is what appeared to be on a pedestal in the middle of the UFO. Like he described it as being like a gyroscope. It was floating in and, you know, it could move but not fixed. And what impressed him the most or fascinated him was on the inside, all the way around the UFO were symbols and markings that looked to him, they weren't familiar, but they looked like what he had seen of hieroglyphics. Mm-hmm. And on the outside, when he went to where the aliens, he called them the little people, were laying, two of them were deceased already. But there was the third one who was still breathing very shallowly. He could see the chest move. So he knelt down beside of him and took him at his wrist and prayed for him. And if you've ever seen the typical alien pictures, the eyes, they don't have lids, so they don't close. So it's as if they're staring directly at you the entire time. And the experience of that is something you don't forget. And he said not long after he prayed over him, he did expire as well. And, of course, he was totally involved in what he was seeing and doing at the moment. But when he looked up, began to see that there was military everywhere, just had begun to drive up and get out of vehicles and come towards them. And it's been reported by other people whom I've never met, that reported that there were FBI and different people there, and just a score of people. And there wasn't. There was the people who lived on the property, of course, seeing the crash, had come down, and there wasn't a lot of fire. There wasn't, the aliens were not burnt. It was a minor fire in the field, and there was a few neighbors that perhaps had been there, and a couple of other people that Granddad assumed, one was we thought a reporter, or he thought a reporter. And when the military did show up, the whole tone changed immediately. They began to take small groups of the people to the side and have individual conversations with them, and telling them basically, this didn't happen. You didn't see this, and you're not ever to speak of it again. This is a matter of national security. Well, Granddad listened, and he would have complied anyway, even if they hadn't said national security, but they didn't intimidate him. It didn't scare him. Granddad was that kind of a man. He was an honorable man. He was very straightforward, and if they said, you know, don't talk about it, then he wasn't going to talk about it. However, after they dropped him off back at home, the family was waiting up, as you would naturally would, wanting to know what had happened, and Granddad related everything to them. But he said he wouldn't speak of it again because they had asked him not to do that. And about 2 weeks, a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks after the fact, there was a knock at the door one evening, again at night, around 8 or 9 o'clock, and there was a gentleman that asked if he could have a word with him privately in his study, and so he did. And after he left, Granddad's grandma said, "Well, what was that about, Will?" And he said, "Well, he had taken this photograph, and he had taken it with his private camera, and it was not confiscated when the military got there because he." It was a small personal camera, and he put it under his coat. They didn't see it. And he had developed a picture, and it was one of the aliens, and two of the men, and it's been reported that it was two policemen that held him up in the picture. That's not true. It was just two individuals that happened to be there. Mm-hmm. And they put one arm, each man on either side of him, put one arm under his armpit and the other near his elbow and held him out because he had very, very long arms, and they took a picture of him. And so he told Granddad this man was even nervous when he showed up, my grandmother said. You could tell he was scared of something. And she said it bothered Granddad that he was so unnerved by it. But he wanted Granddad and asked him, would he take the picture and keep it, because he felt like humanity needed to be aware of it. He wasn't one that had the courage to come forward with it, but would Granddad keep it? And so he did. And that's the picture he gave to my dad kept it for him. And so I had seen that picture from the time I was little up until, I was about 8 or 9. And a friend of Dad's they were having a dinner party, and a friend was a photographer. And he had asked Dad if he could borrow it. He wanted to help him authenticate it and to show it to his parents. And the man's name was Walter Wayne Fisk. He was a personal friend of my mom's and Dad's, and Dad let him take it. And we didn't ever get it back. We did a made-for-TV documentary, and we reenacted a picture, made mm-hmm. it a replica of what it would be like. And so from that was Granddad's part of his experience, his story. But what most people don't know, because I've never spoken of it, but I've never been asked either, that years later, people that know me gave me a copy of the book, The Watchers by Raymond Fowler. Mm-hmm. And in it, he surmises that if someone has had that close of an encounter with an alien being, that they tend to follow the families after that.
Yeah.
And they absolutely have. And that part of my life is still going on. It affected our entire family in many, many different ways. When I was born, my sister's older. She's 2 years older than I am. She was born in May. And I was born in 1943. And when I was born, I came in not knowing even what they meant, with all kinds of gifts that my mother told me they were gifts of God, and I was to hold them sacred, not to ever make fun of them or to use them, and always to explain they came from God. And that has been my life ever since. It's taken many, many different places, and other members of my family were gifted in many ways, but we have been abductees. We've been, I mean, they just are in and out of our life and always have been.
Wow.
So it's quite interesting to me. In my life, in the very beginning, I didn't think of myself as being anybody special. I don't to this day. I'm just like everybody else. You know, you have opportunities and things, gifts that you have, and you either use them or you don't. Mm-hmm. But I don't have any additional things that aren't available to everybody. But I have never turned loose of them, and I speak of them, and it's been my life's work ever since, and it's fascinating. Scary, but fascinating. So that's basically Granddad's story. I was approached after I wrote to Raymond Fowler after I read the book in regard to the part about them following families. And he, in turn, unbeknownst to me, sent a copy of my letter to Lynn Stringfield. And Lynn then, in turn, called me. And at that time, I had Granddad's experience, but I didn't have any of the UFO background, none at all. I didn't know. I just didn't know anything about it. And so I had not heard of Buffon or Lynn Stringfield, or I didn't know who Stan Friedman was. I soon got a crash course. But so after we talked several times on the phone, I found him to be a very kind person, and he told me of some of the work he had done and sent me some of his papers and books and things like that. And one thing has just led to another. It's always you, a door opens and you take a step towards it, and then here's a whole outlay. So I've lived what I call a dual life. In that I had my grandfather in the structured religion on one side, and then on the other side, the other part of the life that was so relevant to me day in and day out. But it was, my life has been very eclectic. The things that have happened to me and others in my family, very eclectic. And Granddad was not the type of man, even before his experience, where he made judgments. He was very open-minded for a Southern Baptist minister, in that it changed his perspective in many ways. Grandmother and I talked about it. She came to my home and stayed with me when she was in the last stages of cancer. She took her chemotherapy at my home in Texas. And it's one thing. My dad was a very flamboyant person, very interesting, and he had a large subject matter that he was interested in. But he tended to lay things on a little thick. So to hear some things from my dad and then to hear them from my grandmother were like difference of night and day. So when she was ill, I tried to talk with her about the many stories and bits and pieces that I had heard through the family. And at first she wouldn't talk to me about it because Grandpa told her not to. But later she began to fill in the blanks for me. And then after she left this world, then whether you want to call it God or the highest consciousness, whatever name you want to put to it, began to reveal to me time and time and time and time again the idiosyncrasies as them being brought together. They aren't separate. They're all one, and we can't have one without the other. We have to embrace it and be open-minded. But also use our brains.
Okay. All right. So I apologize for that. The listener out there may not know or may not care, and that's okay if you don't. But I have been away from home for now. It'll be a month tomorrow, and in hotel rooms. And I have my I have my portable equipment with me. And while I was listening to you, somehow I must have unplugged my microphone. So I apologize. You were asking me. Yes, I do have some questions, and I apologize for
that,
for the listening audience as well. But one of the things I wanted to know is, how did this story get out in the first place, and about when did it come out?
Well, actually, I think it probably got out the first time would have been back in around 1999 to 2000, when I first got in touch with Lynn, or when he got in touch with me, because prior to that I had only reached out to Raymond through a letter. I hadn't talked to anybody else, and no one had ever approached me. And so that, I think that would probably have to have been the beginning. And Leonard had asked to, if he could include my story in a presentation he was making to the MUFON conference that they do each year, and he did it in a book that was entitled "The Status Report Number 6," and he wrote in there. And the interesting part of that is there's so much more to the story that, you know, just the very basics ever got out, and he presented it in that at that time, but Most, I don't think there's anybody that knows. Maybe Stanton Friedman knows. I've discussed it with him. But he also included another story of mine in the same presentation in the epilogue. At one time, it's about summer of 1979. I worked for the phone company then, and I was working at a away from the company, giving a talk, I think, and retired 4-star major general by the name of Melvin McNichol. He had the base when he retired from the Air Force. It was in Oklahoma City at Tinker Field. He also had the base at Wiesbaden, Germany. And after he retired, he was part of the Space Museum there in Oklahoma City. And he called the phone company and described me and wanted my phone number, and they gave it to him. And it began a friendship of about 8 or 9 years that we had that was very, very informative and really, really very helpful in the UFO information. And so he and I discussed, it took him a whole year and a half after we knew each other for him to ever confide in me anything. But one day we got on the subject of UFOs, and he was familiar with Granddad's, because I had told him, Granddad's experience. And I said to him, I said, Mel, you know, is it true? Do you know that there is such a thing as UFOs? Have you ever seen one? Do you know that the Air Force does cover them up? And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, Charlotte, it's absolutely true. And he didn't divulge enough information to get into trouble, but enough to tell me he had walked around one, basically where he was when that happened, and that they did exist, and I asked him, why would they keep it so secret? And he said, Charlotte, the general public cannot handle this. And I said, well, I'm the general public. Of course they could. And he said, you think you are, but you're not.
Oh, wow. Wow, that's interesting, because I don't think that's the way it is today. I feel as though there's more of an openness to it than there's ever been. But, you know,
that's, oh, absolutely.
Yeah. So do you know who leaked the story to begin with? That's what's really puzzling to me.
Well, when I talked originally with Leonard, he promised me that it would never leave his file. That it would be kept secret, and he was good in doing that. He never mentioned my name when he presented it in a symposium, and in the one I just described to you, he called me Cherie Monet.
Okay, but I'm still not getting into. I'm still not getting the what I'm trying to understand here is someone had to leak the story in the very beginning to get it out there. To have him contact you, I mean, was it someone at the scene beside your grandfather? Your grandfather certainly didn't.
Well, what I've been told, I really haven't ever found out that to be exact.
I
talked with Lynn's wife after he passed away, because he had promised they would be secret. And she said people had tried to buy them, but she didn't let anybody have them. But I later heard that Lynn had a stenographer or a secretary that worked with him and helped him keep his files up and keep them, you know, all of that taken care of, and that she had secretly copied his information. I can't speak to that as a truth because that's just what I was told. I don't know exactly where or when it was leaked.
Oh, okay. Someone just made of course, this happened before there was any, investigations back in the 1940s. Before, the late 1940s, there was, as far as we know, no one was actually investigating anything. So that's That is interesting. Now, I do want to tell the listener out there, this is something that people just may think is strange, but it was true at the time, was when there was, you know, car crashes, things like that, when there were people dying or actually dead, it was certainly very, very common for the police to ask a reverend to bless the people, bless the bodies. That was just common. That was always done. So it's nothing, right. That part's not unusual at all. Of course, what the part that's unusual is when they came up to the crash and it wasn't a car crash.
Right.
So, yeah, so that's all interesting. Another thing about the picture that's online, anyone can actually Google that if you just go in and Google and do the Cape Girardeau UFO crash. You will see a picture of, it looks like maybe two brimmed hat people holding up an alien and, you know, that picture. Now, you saw the original picture.
Yes.
Did you have any say into what the picture that was designed for that show, what they came up with? Was that your part of your input was involved in that?
Basically, mine and Jim Mars.
Jim Mars, okay.
Yeah, Jim and I had talked about it because I've been his personal, I guess you would call it reader or advisor, for 23 years. And had worked with him. He took me to the that 1897 Aurora crash scene to check out the little alien there. But we had talked about it, and I basically described what I had seen in the original picture. We just reenacted it with the people at the we did it in Roswell.
I see. Okay. Someone asked a question on the chat room I thought was kind of interesting. Why would people bid on a story that had not been made public?
Why would they bid on it?
Yeah.
I'm not sure I understand the question.
You mentioned just a little while ago that they were trying to, buy the story or buy something.
Mm-hmm.
So what were they trying to buy exactly?
Well, people, a few people that contacted me, they wanted me to sign a release. It wasn't a matter of any money exchanging hands. They wanted the information.
I see.
They didn't want me, or they didn't want me presenting it, and I wouldn't give control over to anybody else. That's my family story, and I wasn't trying to make money. I was simply trying to get the information out to see if other folks could come forward, or just to fill it out.
I got it.
And so that's why you've not heard a lot about it, is because that's not my, it's not what I'm about.
Now I know that I'm trying to think. It's Paul Blake. Is it? Is that who it is? Someone was out there telling this story. Was he and wrote a book on it? How was
MO41? Is that what you're speaking of, Smith?
Paul Blake Smith or something? Yeah, Paul Blake Smith.
Yeah, it is.
And was his story, did he do a fairly accurate job? I mean, you can tell us either way.
How can I be nice about it?
I was afraid that was going
to
happen.
I don't like to attack people. Well, when I heard about it from your podcast, I went and got a copy. And I have never been so upset in all my life.
Oh,
I began to read it. Now, I can only speak to the part that he speaks of my family, which is most of the book, and I'm almost on every page. The only thing that I can tell you that is true that would make this a nonfiction book is the fact that he was born in Cape Girardeau, Missouri.
Oh, ouch. Yeah.
He wrote me two letters in 2014, and he acts like he doesn't even know me, with a long list of questions. I didn't even respond to the letter because what research he had done was so out there in left field, I don't know where he got it. And I don't want to sue him, but I want to stop him. This should never be out there. The way he paints my granddad, the things that he says, there's no truth to him. And
well,
I don't know where.
Let's talk about the inaccuracies then, some of them that bother you the most, just, you know, to get it out there and get it, you know, corrected.
Well, I don't even know where to start, to be honest with you.
Yeah, just touch on some of them. What, what has bothered you?
Well, he makes the statement, the gentleman my dad gave the picture to authenticate, he says that the man would never ever acknowledge me or talk to me. Well, that's not true. I talked to him on the telephone, and at first he was very vague, but he had been a friend of my family's for quite a while, and my mother was quite beautiful, and he had a crush on her. And so I said to him, I said, Wayne, you might not remember me because I was just a kid, but I remembered you brought pheasant for dinner because you had shot it and was explaining all. And I said, do you remember the red-headed woman? And all of a sudden, outburst, Pauline. I said, that's my mother. Oh, he said, yes, now I get it.
Ah, uh-huh.
And so we do know where the photograph, the government has it. He was entangled, and he was very difficult to follow because he would say such outlandish things that couldn't be proven. I mean, Ryan Wood and Bob Wood, they're the ones that we did the documentary together, and Ryan is the only one I've ever given permission to use my information in a book, which was he presented very well in Majestic Eyes Only. I don't think it's in print anymore, but, you know, that's just one thing. Stanton went and saw him and talked to him, and he talked to me on the phone, and, you know, and it's just not true what he says. And then he said that the photo was given back to us. No, it wasn't. It was never given back to us. And, oh, gosh.
Well, I don't want to get you upset here, but it's just I thought it would be a good chance for you to set some things straight that, you know, that bothered you. Because he did write a book. He, you know, you don't make a lot of money on books anyway, but still, you know, he was getting on Coast to Coast and a few other, you know, interviews because of, like, he was the go-to on that subject. And so, but I think it's best to hear from you. So I was really glad that you were willing to come on the show. You know, you're closer to secondhand knowledge to this than anyone else.
Well, the thing of it is, I've never not been here, and people have approached me, and if they've asked me for something in the right vein, I've helped them or tried to give them what they needed, but not many people came to me. And, you know, there is always a time and a place. I believe that. And now is the time for the truth to be out. And so it's happening.
Now, I do want to talk about the abduction situation and stuff like that. I want to make sure that we do not forget to talk about that. But I want to go back to...
No, that's okay.
I want to go back to the photo because this is really fascinating me.
Sure.
Fascinating to me. You actually saw this... now, your grandfather wouldn't have showed this to you. I mean, he didn't want to talk about it.
No, no.
How did that float around in the family? How did that...
Well, it actually didn't ever float around. It just went from my grandfather, not long after he got it, to my dad. Dad kept it at the house. And when there would be times that my parents would have guests over, dinner parties, and that subject would come up one way or another or something similar, and Dad would relate the story, and he would show the picture. Back then, I guess the magnitude of what it was really didn't hit us, because, well, especially myself and my brothers and sisters, because it was just always around, and we didn't think it was anything so much out of the ordinary. We thought all people knew all this stuff.
Wow.
you know, when you grow up with something and it's around you all the time, you don't question it much.
That's right. But, that's right.
You know, it was just in the family pictures. I mean, I could have gone at any time and opened the picture box and taken it out.
Now,
you know.
Can you tell me, let's just describe the photo. I know I'm kind of focusing on that probably a little too much.
Okay.
But if, first of all, was it real clear? You could actually see the being?
Oh, very
really
clear.
Okay.
Yeah, very clear. And that was one of the things in Smith's book that really bothered me, because it said it, I forgot what her name was, but somebody had contacted him and they had taken or described the picture. That Walter had described a picture to somebody, and they thought it was could look like something from out of the sea and changed, like shapeshift. I don't know what that was about, but no, it was. Remember back, you may not be as old as I am, but if you remember back when the pictures with the little Kodak cameras and they had the little scallops and the little...
Oh, absolutely. I see
remember
them,
the scalloping?
I see them all the time in old photo albums, the little scalloped edges. Yeah.
Right. It looked like that, and then it had a big tree in it, and there was grass. You could tell it wasn't a yard because the grass was like knee high or so. And the two men, you know, holding this alien, and it's very clear. And I can remember people asking me questions about the feet or the legs. I couldn't tell you a lot about them because I was always fixated on the eyes.
Sure.
There's something very haunting about the eyes. They almost have an energy of their own, and it's otherworldly, and it didn't frighten me as a child. It just pulled me in, and I really always had a feeling of sympathy for them, because being what they were, according to my granddad, you know, that's something that they're very far from home and they've crashed, and you know, there was always a little bit of a sadness to me in it. But yeah, the picture was very clear.
Now, I want to mention something about eyes. First of all, in a conversation that I had with Travis Walton, he said,
yeah, I know.
The eyes, you know, were the scariest part of all, and also
they can be scary.
Yeah, and then the stare. He said the stare was something. And then I had a conversation last summer with someone that was a girl that was involved at the Ariel School, you know, encounter.
Redheaded.
But I know who that is. God, her name, Selma Siddick. And she said that when she had to leave to find out if her brother and sister were okay in the schoolyard, she said breaking that stare was from that being, whatever it was one of the hardest things she'd ever done, is to break the stare to go.
It's very hypnotic. It pulls you in, even from the photograph. I mean, I don't know how Granddad felt, but I know his perspectives changed. And, you know, he was very out of the box, more so than he had ever been after that. Much more loving. He was always a loving person, but outwardly showing it. It is very hypnotic, even through the photograph, it was to me.
Yeah. So when your grandfather came out and said, he said, I'm only going to tell this one time and told the story, did, I know this is kind of a weird question perhaps, but did anyone write any notes, or this is, you said that your father and your grandmother both remembered it quite differently. Are those the only two perspectives that you had on the
well,
story?
Well, it isn't that they remembered it differently. It's just that Grandma told it almost like you would read a historical document.
I see.
That's my grandmother. My grandfather and daddy were much more charismatic, I guess would be the word, and Granddad didn't embellish, but Dad would.
Ah, okay.
You know, if one was you know, one was a good thing, then put two in there. That's even better. You know, so he had that about him. And that part I didn't trust exactly. So I needed to hear it from more than that perspective in order to really get to what the real truth was.
So I think that is amazing that it changed changed his perspective. It sounds like it did a little bit, or you know, made him more open, as you said. And he kept his word all the way to the end. He never ever would, even like on his last few days, he would never talk about it again.
As far as I know, he never did. Now, I think from what Daddy said, that they may have had a few private conversations. If Dad would come up with a question, he may have answered it, but to him only.
I see.
It was more through Granddad's behavior and the way he handles things that we could tell a difference in him.
Mm-hmm.
But no, he didn't ever speak publicly to anybody else.
Wow.
But he was a private man to begin with.
Now, back then, they wouldn't have called it flying saucer or UFO. Did I hear you say the word a spaceship? Did they call it that? Or what did they say? What did they think that crashed, or what were they talking about on the site?
Well, on the site, they just called it different things. One would call it a spaceship. One would call it something from outer space or beyond our world. I mean, there were several different terms used because there wasn't anything that at the time. One man called it a cigar-like.
Hmm.
And,
which is there's a lot of descriptions of the cigar-shaped craft. So certainly could have been.
Well, and it is from what angle do you see it? I don't know that anybody ever saw it as it came down. It was already crashed. And so as you kind of drove over the little hill, and there it was, it depended on what angle, what direction you were coming it that you saw.
Right.
Which could make the difference as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, they called it several things.
Now, it always makes you wonder, okay, so if this truly did happen, and it sounds like it, a very believable case, if this happened, what the heck did they do with the bodies? What the heck did they do with the remains of the craft? You know, I mean, that's always a question.
The military came and took it all away.
Yeah, and where'd it go?
not unlike, different at the time, different bases. I remember when I was talking to Mel, the retired Major General. He spoke of Wright Patterson. He spoke of
Wright Field at the time. It was called.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and. One on the East Coast, or the West Coast. He never gave the name exactly, but they had one hangar there, and you could walk around it. They weren't allowed to touch it. They weren't allowed to go into it. And whenever things would happen, even being retired, he used to be called back to Washington for what he called grayouts. And I'm not sure, because he couldn't go into it, as to what those were, but they were of high national security and very, very secretive.
Wow. And now the hieroglyphics, or what appeared to be hieroglyphics, that's pretty very interesting to me. First of all, there's two other cases that are pretty well known, purportedly, that there were hieroglyphics. One of them would be, of course, Roswell, and the second one, Rendlesham Forest, the Rendlesham Forest
incident. I'm
familiar
with Rendlesham.
Yeah. There was someone that supposedly went right up and actually touched the craft, named Jim Peniston, who's actually going to be on this show here in sometime in April. But
you'll enjoy him.
What's that?
You'll enjoy him.
Well, Yeah, so they both talk about the same thing. There were stories about hieroglyphics, which I think is really interesting. I guess it makes sense. I mean, it's like any craft that we have that goes out there into space or anywhere else has, you know, as far as America
lettering
goes, has the flag on it and, all kinds of numbers and things like that. So,
right.
Yeah, that's not surprising.
And from what I've seen, because Daddy tried to show me kind of, what they look like, symbols, and they can look very similar. And the closest thing that people have seen in a lot of cases are the Egyptian hieroglyphics.
Hmm. Well, they tell the story. Every symbol tells a story.
Yes.
Now, let's talk now about what has happened in your family. You started to mention that that you feel as though that there's been abductions, and you have a personal experience in that. So, if you would, if it's something that's not too painful to talk about, can you tell the listening audience what has happened?
Well, I can tell you of some in the family. My older sister probably is the one that had, and she's deceased now, but before she passed away, she wrote a notarized letter stating that this was true information. She recalled a lot of the actual being floated into, out the window and into the spacecraft, and experiments being done, although she didn't know what was being done. The interesting thing is we used to have in-depth conversations, her and I. We were very close, best friends. And at one point, when I was first beginning to dip my toe in the UFO stuff, trying to make myself aware, I said, "Sis, tell me some of your experiences, and I'll tell you, what I have." And about a month later, Raymond Fowler wrote me a letter and asked, could he speak with her? Would she speak to him? And I went to her and asked her, and she looked at me with the blankest face I've ever seen, and she said, "I don't have any idea what you're talking about."
Really?
Yes.
Interesting.
And
wow.
I was chilled to the bones, and I tried to refresh your memory. Didn't do one bit of good.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, and so I had to write back and tell him what had happened, and she never did come forward with that. But later, some other situations would come about. Myself, I can recall being, if it started to get dark, I would be very, very afraid, and I didn't understand why, but I would wait for my family to go to bed, my mother especially, and I would go in the bathroom and shut the door and turn the light on, and I would stay there until I would see daylight come in up through the window, and then I would quickly go get in my bed.
That's no way to live. That must have been exhausting.
Well, it was, and I didn't quite understand why, but later understood that the missing time, could be retained. You could go back and reclaim it. I didn't want to. I didn't care what was in there. I just knew I didn't want it anymore. And I have a daughter and an adoptive son that I have a bedroom here in my home. And both of them started out at one time in that bedroom, and they both asked to be moved because they come to that window and they don't want to be taken. That happens not a lot, but occasionally. And they do recall being taken. And my younger brother does as well.
Wow. Well, this is the question came up in the chat room earlier, and it's always been a curious one to me, is why the multiple abductions if these are happening. But I want to ask you this question first before you answer that. When was it you first recall it happening, or your sister talked about it happening? I'm talking about what year approximately, if you can remember.
The first time that she talked about it to me, she was about, it was in the late 60s, middle 60s to early late 60s.
Wow. So during that time, I can only think of Betty and Barney Hill in 1961. But yeah. You never really heard about any abduction-type situations happening for many, many years.
And when she was born with the gift of clairvoyance. We didn't know that's what it was called. And it scared her to death. She's probably the most gifted clairvoyant I have ever met. It scared her, like I said. And this was in the 50s. She would see visions and pictures of things on the magnitude of 9/11. And back in the 50s, you just didn't, that just wasn't heard of. And my grandmother, my mother's mother, who lived with us most of her life, was a great deal of Indian. And she told her, she said, honey, if you're not comfortable with that gift God has given you, ask him to take it away, and he will. It won't make him mad. And she did, and it went away. So it can be very, very difficult. And I hadn't heard, as far as, I was fascinated when I heard about Betty Andrews. I heard about it in the 70s.
Mm. So you had already had situations happening before that time then?
Oh, gosh, yes. One time that I remember, the entire family was involved. There were bad storms going on, and we used to go every weekend on a Saturday. We got our allowance, and Mom and Dad would take us into town or to town where we could spend our allowances, and it was a big thing for us. And so we left our house and headed to the town nearest to us, and it took us by, well, we were gone by our time, an hour and a half to what should have been a 20-minute ride, and instead of ending up the town that we were headed to, we were driving back in our own driveway. And we don't know how the car got turned around. And my dad finally surmised, well, maybe a tornado came and picked us up and we didn't know it and took us back. But we later realized that it had to have been an encounter of some kind. So, yes, I've lived with this my whole life. My whole family has.
That's amazing. And of course, the missing time thing, I don't even know if that was discussed for a long time, even from, you know, Betty and Barney Hill.
Right.
That's what you hear, you know, you hear this type of thing all the time. And people ending up, like you were saying, ending up in a completely different place than they remembered they were at. But
right,
for a whole
right.
entire family, that's an amazing, that's a crazy one.
Well, you know, I think there's probably a lot more of it, but it's not spoken of, or mm-hmm. that people don't, you kind of have to go through time and then look back and see the different things that happen and when, and it begins then to make sense, or you see the pattern of it. We were always from a very eclectic family. In fact, I can remember my grandfather. We would always be in church, of course. He'd be preaching along, and when I was little, I would hear him do a sermon, and I would stand up and I'd say, Grandpa, that's wrong. That's not right. And, of course, everybody would just roar because it's a kid. But I knew at the time what he was saying was wrong. Wasn't mm-hmm. the truth.
Wow. Someone wanted to know in chat, have you ever seen a UFO yourself?
Yes, more than once.
Oh, can you describe?
Well, all of my family has.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, the one that I saw was over our home at one time. And we had been out playing, and we came back in. There were four of us. I have two sisters and a brother. And I remember, I get it by feeling. I feel them more than anything, because there's an intensity and a vibration to it that is very, very hard to ignore if you've ever heard it or felt it. I felt that, and I knew that one was either there or was coming. And so I didn't want to alarm anybody else in case I was wrong, and I stepped outside onto the porch, and was quite a ways from me, so it didn't appear to be as large as it probably was, and I was young anyway, but I saw one go skimming across the sky above tree level, and as I looked up, the minute I caught my eye in that range, it was gone within a blink of the eye.
Wow, interesting. So when your grandfather, when he was describing, you know, being there on the site, and he saw that this crash was open, you know, the craft was actually open or broken open or something like that, did he ever say the size of it, about, you know, like it looked like it was 30 feet wide, or did he ever talk about how
if it was? He didn't give dimensions to anything I heard ever. I don't know that. I don't remember my dad even mentioning it. I don't think it was ever mentioned unless it was between the two of them privately. We didn't ever hear about it.
And did he ever say how far off of the main road that it was where they went to?
They had gone, he said, about between 13 and 15 miles outside of town. And then they parked on the side of the road and went into the field about a quarter to half a mile in to the wreckage, to where it had happened.
And did anyone ever say to him how they found this? I mean, was there any casual conversation, or was it all just you go there, you bless the bodies, and you leave? Was it that type of thing?
No, I think he had a little bit of conversation with the owners of the property, because they were standing out there. I mean, they were already there.
So the owners of the property. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they had walked down from the house, and a farming family, and man and wife, and, you know, they were concerned. And he was just, I think, from what Grandma said, that Granddad told her, that he was kind of like in shock.
Sure.
He didn't say very much, but the look on his face, Granddad was a little concerned about he and his wife both, that, you know, they just couldn't accept what they were seeing. Just hard to accept.
Right. Well, I mean, it's just completely out of, you know, the realm of what you would expect to see. So it's really hard to get your head around when you see something like that. It certainly,
absolutely,
certainly could be in shock. So you're not the first person on the show that has said that they have felt like there was going to be, you know, a sighting or a UFO. But why did you hold back on why do you think you held back on not telling anyone, like, when you had that feeling? Were you embarrassed about it, or?
Oh, no. No, I wasn't embarrassed about it, and I didn't think about any of that. It's like your mindset changes.
Oh, I see.
And you're not really thinking of what you ordinarily would. Your mind is not that of a regular person.
Ah, okay.
Is the best way I know how to describe it.
Uh-huh. And did you, the part where you told us about, you know, your sister just completely, I don't know if it's denying it, or do you think that she totally forgot? I mean, like it was wiped out?
No, I think it had been wiped completely out of her mind, like it never happened, because my sister, we couldn't tell each other a lie or a story. We were that transparent with each other, and it was just like I could tell. It was like all of a sudden nobody was home.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. You know, just the eyes kind of like glazed over, and she looked at me like, who are you?
Wow.
What are you talking about? And so I didn't push it at the time, and I didn't want to know what was in my missing time for a long, long time, and I didn't trust. Your mind is a very important thing to guard, and I didn't want just anybody to hypnotize me. At one point, I was thought about having Bud Hopkins. I would have trusted him, and he was sick at the time. And the last time I talked with Stan, I hadn't heard from him, and I didn't want to bother him. And so Stan said he contacted him. He was very sick. But I was regressed one time and had one experience come through a little bit, and that was enough for me.
I bet. I mean, that's something a lot of people are very reluctant to do, and I totally get that. And, you know, I'm not sure if something like that happened to me, I think I would probably be the same way. I'm sorry. I'm in a hotel room, and my dog keeps barking. I do apologize for that.
No, that's okay.
I can't do anything about that right now. Can you talk about more about what you consider the gifts that your family had? Clairvoyance. What about you?
For the last 35 years of my life, we used to do what my mother called fortune telling. You know, her and Grandma used a deck of cards. Mm-hmm. And they would shuffle cards, and they would give what they called readings to people and tell them about their future. That had more to do with my grandma and her Native American side than it did anything else. But when I came in, I touch people. If I touch you, I can tell you if a person is genuine, if they're lying to you, if they're not really connected, if you will. Oftentimes I have a lot of people, they'll say, well, is so-and-so real, for real? Can I go and pay my money to that person? If I can touch them, I can tell you. And I do readings for people, and have for the last 30 years by touch. Wow. I'm not saying that there aren't other people that are psychic or that have those abilities. It's not mine. At different times when situations come up, I have worked with the police for missing people.
Really?
If you bring me, if you bring me something that I can touch that was the person's, I can give you information about them. And I don't like to do those cases because you share that space and you go through some of it. But if God tells me to do it, I do it. So I do that occasionally. I can take information. I had to learn to put energy around me and protection around me so that when I go somewhere like Walmart, I don't pick up everybody's stuff. So, you know, it's a gift in one way. In another way, it's not always wonderful to know things that, you know, you're not supposed to know.
I'm sure.
But I have it, and I've learned the jargon that goes with it, as far as I didn't know what psychometry was. I now know what it is. All I knew is somebody put a picture in my hand one time, and immediately I began to see pictures, just like watching a movie screen.
Interesting. Wow.
And, you know, I relay that information. I have a lot of men that come to me for investments. It's not just all psychic stuff. I mean, it's everyday nuts and bolts things that they want to know.
Wow. Someone in chat, we've already touched on this a little bit, but maybe we can talk a little bit more. Have you looked into cases that were, you know, like Travis Walton and Betty and Barney Hill, cases like that? Have you paid attention to those things?
You know, I'm not a researcher. Mm-hmm. I'm an experiencer.
Yeah.
Okay. And they're different, and they all have their place. I know that Travis, the first time I met him and I touched him, I made him cry, and I cried. I didn't mean to make him cry, but there is that. I think it's that soul knowingness that you've been where they are. Mm-hmm. My question to him was, I was not prepared for the politics and all the stuff that goes along with this kind of stuff. I didn't know it existed. And so many people had been you know, trying to get me to change when it happened and to change this and to change that. And I asked him, did that happen to him? And he looked at me and he said, all the time, stay true to your truth. And there's a bond for me, and I haven't talked to him about it at all. And I don't mean to imply that we're close friends. We're not. But I have been where he's at, and I've heard him speak, and I've touched him. And there's just something that when I see him, it's like seeing the truth in another person. I mean, the truth to the depths of what it is. He knows.
Well, I'll tell you, I have never felt anything but honesty and, you know, sitting across from him, talking to him.
And yeah.
The best time, not talking on the show, the best time I sat, I was at a conference that he was at, and he and I were sitting in a back room right by a restaurant door where the wait staff was going in and out. And we sat there for about a couple hours and just talked about other things, and then we got into a real deep, you know, some deep, really deep conversations and, you know, off the record that I think Travis is 100% legit myself. And
absolutely.
Yeah.
And when he lost his brother, he just, I mean, his brother was his,
yeah,
his, you know, rock for him.
Right.
And, and, you know, that happens with a lot of people. When you know somebody and you know that they are real to the core and the soul of who they are, when you lose them, you've really lost something. I experienced that with Jim Mars.
Right, right. I had Jim Mars on the show one time. He's a nice guy. He was fun to talk to.
Yeah, yeah, he was. Well, you know, he made a joke of just about everything. And several times he would say, Charlotte, why do I not get approached this way or that way? And I'd say, Jim, you don't even know the value of who you are. And if you don't know it, you know, other people are not going to they don't respect that. They take it as a joke. And he would shake his head. He said, just too much of a good old boy. And that was him.
Yeah, he was a Texan too. And did you
live
near each other?
We didn't, well, maybe 80 some miles, close enough that he would come here for his reading sometimes, and I'd go spend the weekend at his house. And when he passed, we shot some of his ashes out of a cannon.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. Oh, he was quite the character. Quite the character.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. Interesting. Going back to this case, as far as you know, has anyone else that was on that site talked about, you know, any other witness talked about what they saw?
Not firsthand, no. Not that I'm aware of. The closest that there has been is that when Ryan Wood did some of his research for the book that I was aware of and agreed to let him do, would have been the son of the sheriff at the time. And it was that he didn't have firsthand knowledge, but he said he did remember hearing of a crashed UFO and little people. And that would be the only one that I'm aware of. Now, I don't know what research I haven't, after he did the book, he went on to other things, and so did I. But he could have gotten more information because he had a website up for people to contact him. Mm-hmm. But I haven't heard from him that he found anybody.
Yeah,
with firsthand information.
You know, it was also different times when back then, you know, of course, this was just when the war was getting ready to start at the end of the same year. Everyone listened to the government. The government, someone from the military said, you know, you don't talk about this.
And you know, didn't.
They absolutely didn't. It was a different time. I don't
it
think
was a
be,
different time.
Today, if this happened, there'd be iPhones snapping away and you'd be on Instagram and everything else.
Wouldn't be possible in this day and time.
That's right. Yeah.
It just wouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah. It would just be a viral thing. But so we have just about 10 minutes left. And
okay.
So I don't know if this at this point, you know, I could take some questions in from the chat room. But if you think that besides Paul Blake Smith's book, what are some other misconceptions? You said there was a lot out there that was, you know, a lot of people out there that were telling the story and they were telling it wrong or telling your story wrong.
Well, some of it's little things and some of it's bigger things. Like I've seen it printed everywhere that Granddad went out to give last rites. He was Baptist. They don't do last rites.
Catholic does, right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's Catholic. And, you know, they can be as small as that. And when I read that, it's like, well, they don't really know what they're talking about. They've read some of the other stuff. And misconceptions of the number of people that were there. Like they say that the picture was two policemen holding the alien up. No, it wasn't at all. I only know of the police in connection with who came and picked up my granddad was from the police department. And it had been mentioned at one place that the FBI was there. No, they weren't. The only people that were there were the people from the farmhouse, one or two neighbors, which there weren't many because the property was not close, not like houses next door and things. I think probably that where they radio through the police, like the newspaper will pick those things up, a few people like that, but there probably wasn't. I've heard and read that there were lots of people there. There wasn't maybe tops 15, if that many. Sometimes the time being earlier. I've had some that I've read that they've got it in different towns that they're close, but not where mine granddad's was. So they'll have different locations. They'll have different times of the day. This was at night. You know, I don't think anybody would think 9 or 9:30 at night is like 6 or 5 or 6. You know, just things like that.
Now, one of the questions that always seems to come up, and a question that I have too, is a crash. Why a crash? I mean, of course, you have no answer. I have no answer, but it is curious as to why a craft would crash to begin with, especially if it was from an alien planet or some other place. Of course, we really don't. I don't think there's anyone that really knows for sure where these things or wherever or whatever are coming from. But still, it is a curious thing why a craft would, if it did travel, you know, such a long distance, how it would crash on the Earth. That is a bizarre thought.
Well, I don't find it being so bizarre. You know, there is no such thing as perfection. I don't care how many years you've been around or how intelligent you've become. There is no perfection. And so things can go wrong. The fact that they travel that far would, to me, say the possibility of something happen rises rather than falls. And not knowing what their propulsion is, I know in the 60s, you know, there's a colony under Mount Shasta. They're all over. It has to do with a lot of times the paths and how they run with actual impulses, the grids, the electronic grids, many things can go wrong. And so I can't see why they wouldn't.
Okay, well, it's always good to hear a different perspective on that in particular. And I, you know, it's just a thought. And you know, has anyone that you've talked to ever thought it could be something else besides aliens? Or do you think that's kind of the direction that the thoughts were on the people that interviewed you and you have spoken with over the years about this?
I've never had anybody go that direction. the majority of the people that I've talked to believe that that's the case, because it has to do with not just what is in front of you, but what are you feeling? Because we are multifaceted, and we're more than human beings. We're only 50% human. The other 50% is the spiritual side of us, and that, you know, there are no boundaries to that. And if you, I started out, and I followed all the major religions. I attended the Parliament of the World Religions in 1993. There was 128 religions represented. And when you get into the nuts and bolts of all of them, there is a thread that runs between them. That is who we all are, where we all come from. And so, you know, knowing that they're not like us, they don't look like this, if you have any kind of contact, you realize that. And it's the feeling that you get in your soul that this is extremely different. It's not like you go to another country and you see, yes, people who look different than you do. There is a feeling of that difference on the degree and that level that it can't be from here. Hard to explain. It's more about feeling than it is explaining it.
Sure. Going back to what you said earlier about staying up until, you know, locking yourself in the bathroom.
Basically. Yeah, daylight.
Yeah. Did all of your experiences and from what you knew of your sister's experiences before that all got blanked out from her, did everything occur during the nighttime only?
It didn't always, but the majority of the time it was at night. It's a lot easier to travel, to be out of your body, to have experiences when the vibrational level of the humans on the earth is at a lower point. Not as much going on, not as much to break that. You can get through from the other side, if you will, because I do a lot of connecting families with deceased loved ones. I do a lot of work with people who have family that's committed suicide. For them to be able to reach through is much easier when there's not as much of that energy, that vibration. So it's easier at night than it is during the day. But no, there are things that have happened in broad daylight.
And you know, the situation with your family, you know, you said you got to speak to your grandmother. I don't know exactly when she passed or whatever.
1984.
So there was a lot of talk. You know, she saw all the UFO flaps going on and stuff like that. Do you know, did your family pay attention to those things, or was this just something that, you know, it was just the family situation that happened and they didn't discuss anything else?
Okay, when you say the UFO flaps in regards to my grandmother, I'm not sure what you're speaking of.
I'm just saying there was a lot in the news, you know, during like 1952.
Oh, no, we didn't follow any of that.
You didn't? Okay.
No. We didn't follow any of that. We didn't. It's hard to imagine. That was an incident that happened in our family, and we kind of just put it up on the shelf. And, you know, other than the fact that I continued to want to validate it for myself, and that's all it was about, was to validate it for myself, and then later to see if it explained why I was the way I was and my life was the way it was. We didn't follow any of it. In fact, when the first time that Stanton Friedman called me, he got my number from Lynn Stringfield. I didn't know who he was.
Uh-huh, sure.
Mm-hmm. I had not heard of him. And I felt bad because you could tell it was hard for him to imagine that. I didn't know who he was. and so he sent me a couple of his books, and it's like, oh, yeah, I'd seen him.
Yeah.
I called him the weird professor, you know, but no, we didn't follow it. So.
Well, Charlotte, we're at the end of the show. I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's
well, you're very welcome. I appreciate the opportunity to kind of set things straight.
Sure.
Because I think people are owed the truth, and it ought to be what it is.
That's right. I really appreciate it. And maybe we'll see you out there speaking, you know, getting the story out more. That would be nice to see that.
Oh, well, in regards to that, I've been asked, Alejandro has asked me to speak at the International UFO Congress this year.
So I nudged him and it worked.
You did.
All right. Excellent. That's wonderful. I'll see you in October. Is it October or September?
No, it's September. September 4th through the 8th.
Okay. I'll see you then. All right, Charlotte.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
I look forward to it.
You bet. You take care of yourself.
Bye-bye. You
bye-bye.
Too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. That's it for our show this evening. And next week, we have Earl Gray on. He's a great guy. I can't wait to have him on. That'll be a lot of fun. And so I do want to thank everyone, first of all, for listening to the show. And second of all the people that support the show. I want to thank you very much. And I also want to thank the people behind the scenes that helped this happen. Peggy helps out with the Facebook, our Facebook page. You can like us on Facebook because we always have new UFO stories up there. All right, we'll be back next week. And remember, everyone, to keep your eyes to the sky.